Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation on this Aloha Friday, August 23rd. Hawaii Talks. Hawaii's Ukrainian community marked its independence this weekend as fighting in their homeland and in Russia intensifies. The Maui Community Land Trust secures its first parcel to keep Lahaina land in Lahaina hands. So what happens now? We tip our hat to Duke Kahanamoku as Duke's Ocean Fest winds up this weekend. We hear about a new book highlighting the golden age of swimming and the Paris Olympics kings of the water. And comedian Paula Poundstone is back in town. She shares her favorite moment from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me ahead of her show at Hawaii Theater. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Tomorrow marks Ukraine Independence Day. For the last few years, it's been battling Russia at its borders. Here in Hawaii, community members have been standing in solidarity with the Eastern European country since the war started in 2022. Back then, the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra with conductor Dane Lamb played the Ukraine national anthem at a performance shortly after the invasion. In recent weeks, Ukraine has been on the offensive, attacking Moscow bridges and airfields, and there are threats that Russia may retaliate even further this weekend. Laura Palafox is with the group Hawaii Stands with Ukraine. She joins us to talk about where things stand. The community of Ukrainians in the islands is said to be growing and is gathering for an Independence Day festival this Saturday.
Well, this day is extremely important given the current circumstances of the invasion of Ukraine, where Russia is trying to take away the independence that Ukraine got back in 1991. So, you know, the event is not just symbolic of this fight, but it's also very important for Ukrainians, you know, to come together and support each other, so emotionally as well. And also as a way to be defiant and to show that our culture lives on, that it will not be destroyed and it will not be taken away.
And this year, folks in the community have banded together and you're creating a new nonprofit.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
Right. So, well, actually, so Leo Hura had the idea to start a Ukrainian cultural center as a way for, you know, people to gather in the long term. So to come together and share their cultures and to sort of build it, because the last couple of years when I was organizing the Independence Day event, it was a wonderful, wonderful event, but we've just been seeing it grow, which is even better, more fantastic. So more and more people are coming, and actually some people have newly arrived on the islands with incredible talent. So this is a great opportunity to really just build a cultural center, a point where we can all sort of rally around and also to share our culture with the community.
Well, give us a sense of the numbers.
Well, so on I would say on the islands in total, we're thinking around 2,000 right now. And we've had 200 refugees, at least 200 refugees come over to Hawaii as well. So as has been mentioned, Ukrainians here have been here a long time, some of them. And, you know, dating back to the days of the sugar industry, you know, working in the sugarcane fields. And so, you know, some Ukrainians have come because they've had family here and others have been sponsored. So they've come in different ways, but it's just, you know, the population has been growing slowly, obviously not as huge as some other cities in the U.S., but it's been growing nevertheless.
And so this is a way to be able to unite Ukrainians, whether they're on the Big Island or here on Oahu, because they are spread out, you know, depending on, you know, who was able to sponsor them to come over.
Right. Yes, exactly. So, yeah, we have Ukrainians on Kauai, on the Big Island, on Maui. Unfortunately, also were affected by the fires that happened in Maui, and so I'm no longer there. But we do have other Ukrainians still there, still on Maui, people who go over and volunteer from our community, helping out over there. So, yeah, we have Ukrainians scattered all around the islands. The most, of course, are on Oahu. And some are flying in for this event as well from other islands.
Well, you know, sadly, this conflict has stretched on and, you know, folks are fearful for their loved ones over there. You know, there's threat of, you know, additional attacks, you know, over this weekend. And I'm sure you have friends and family that you're concerned about.
Absolutely. It's heartbreaking. I have family over there. I have relatives there who've had to escape from the town that was captured by Russian soldiers, only to move to a town that was then bombed by Russia. And really just everybody lives in a state of panic and they're in survival mode continually. And this really wears down on people's conscience and on their emotions. And I have my brother there. I can't say where, but he is there helping out. And as a lot of people who are, you know, the diaspora of Ukraine who've gone and lived in other countries, and now going back and bringing supplies, bringing things that are needed, you know, all kinds of equipment that is helpful, you know, military, not just like military equipment, not so much that, but more things like IFAC, you know, which are first aid kits for soldiers to carry. So things like that, that just amazingly, something as simple as that will save lives so that soldiers, you know, don't bleed out on the front. So family there constantly get reports daily. I know what's happening, you know, and the thing I think has sort of died out in the news is the terroristic attacks that the Russian military are doing. You know, they're letting off poison bombs there, which is biological warfare. And, you know, it's against the Geneva Convention. It's, you know, against the rules of war, you know, as much as there are rules of war. But no, it's horrific. But I have to say some things are inspiring in the sense of we are seeing more and more, you know, success with Ukrainians militarily going into Russia and capturing Kursk, for example. Using drones to hit military targets, you know, to slow Russia down. We're seeing, you know, there is also an alliance of different groups that have been repressed by Russia who are, you know, were forced to have a Russian passport. For example, you know, in Bashkiria and Chechnya and Ingushetia and Tatarstan and other places. And they are joining forces with Ukrainians. Some of them are escaping, going over to Ukraine and joining forces, you know, because they don't, you know, they're opposed to the Putin regime and what they're doing, the war.
I'm sure we will see many flags of yellow and blue there on Saturday. And so if folks want to come out and support the Ukrainian community, what do they need to know?
Right. You know, this is a festival. And so, you know, it's a wonderful festival of dance and music and really the joy of culture. So please, it's open to the public. And we really invite anybody who supports, you know, Ukraine's independence and who wants to get a taste of the culture and food and come on out to Kapi'olani Park Bandstand on this Saturday, the 24th, And it's from 10:30 until 4, and it's a huge program. We have a lot of local groups joining. We have, you know, Halau Mele, we have Te Matahi, we have an opera singer, we have, you know, various groups, the Royal Hawaiian Band Glee Club. So many others are participating in this, so it's really a community event. So we would love to share, you know, our culture and for people to folks to have a good time, really. It is about just having a good time on this day and supporting Ukraine.
All right. Well, Laura Palafox, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you so much. Mahalo and aloha.
That was Laura Palafox talking to us this morning about a Ukrainian cultural festival that will take place at Kapi'olani Bandstand tomorrow morning starting at 10:30 a.m. We will have links on our website after the show.
On the next Science Friday, astronaut Katie Coleman on looking down on Earth from orbit.
First of all, I just don't feel that far away. You know, I feel like home is bigger than we thought. And I just happen to be one of the furthest out people.
That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaiian Telcom, now offering Phioptics Plus TV service statewide, giving Neighbor Island families a choice in TV providers. HawaiianTel.com/Phioptics Plus.
You know, we recently highlighted the Lahaina Community Land Trust that was created to keep Lahaina lands in Lahaina hands. Today we learn more about the first deal that's been brokered. HPR reporter Catherine Kluwet-Pachtel joins us with the latest. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Yeah, so this is pretty exciting stuff.
It is. So the Lahaina Community Land Trust has signed paperwork on its first land purchase, and it's a Wahikuli property that before the fire had a four-bedroom, three-bathroom home on it. It is zoned for one home and two ohana units. So it would be really good for a multi-generational family, extended ohana situation. It was sold by the Kimballs, who are a couple in their 80s, who lived in Lahaina since 2007. Here is executive director of the Lahaina Community Land Trust, Autumn Ness, and she's talking about the sellers of this first property.
When he accepted our offer, he said that, you know, the longer we lived in Lahaina, the less we felt like home, because we understood and we learned what had happened with land and the Hawaiian people over history. So because all this happened, we're honored to be able to sell to you. And he said, and I quote, "It never really belonged to us anyway. It belongs to the Hawaiian people." So there's so many layers to this one relationship and this one parcel. And that's going to be the case moving forward for every parcel, right? Every piece of land has so much history and the story behind it. In this day and age, when we talk about land so quickly as, you know, what's the cost? What is it? What did you pay to buy it? How much did you make when you sold it? And how much money is this land bringing in? It's really interesting to and beautiful to talk to someone who looks at land as a legacy. Not how much can I get for it, but what do I want this land to do when after I'm pass it on, you know? So I'm really glad that this was our first purchase.
Yeah, it's an amazing story.
It is, and it's still in escrow, but all the paperwork is signed and things are moving forward. There's no timeline for building a home on it yet. Autumn said that they're, you know, working with contractors and materials, you know, are in high demand. Lots of cost and delay considerations, especially with everyone else also looking at rebuilding in Lahaina. So they're not putting a rush on it, but, you know, looking to the long term, it's a really special opportunity for a Lahaina family in the future. Here's Rick Kimball explaining what led up to the sale.
We escaped the fire. We left when the smoke alarm went off and went out to Maui Prep, which was the first place where you could go if you became a refugee. The following weekend, we left Maui to go and stay with family in the mainland in Montana because we had no other place to go. So we stayed with our family in Montana till after Christmas, and then we moved to San Luis Obispo in Central California. You know, we're both 82, and we figured as much as we loved Lahaina, we would probably not want to go back to build. It would just be beyond our capability at our age. And I had one time been involved in the startup of a land trust in California, so I was very familiar with how they worked. And so we had a good friend at church who said that, you know, she went to the meetings and things like that, and she said that at one of the meetings, they made a mention that there was an effort going to start a land trust there in Lahaina. And so I contacted Autumn Ness, and that's when the process started. And we were sort of in first position because they were liking the idea of doing what they're doing now, acquiring property and making it into affordable housing for the locals there. And it was just a matter of time of going through the process.
So this sounds like a really good fit for the Kimballs and for this trust.
It does. And it's, you know, a unique situation where the Kimballs approached the land trust and, you know, were wanting to make this happen. And so I think that was part of the success behind this first purchase. And he talked about, you know, wanting their property to be used for good, not just purchased by an investor. And they got letters in the mail with purchase offers on their property, you know, from solicitors. And I think, like so many Lahaina residents have, you know, that was really concerning for them. And so they took this step forward to keep that land in perpetuity for the community. So here's how it works. The land trust gets independent appraisals for land, and they make an offer. And assuming, you know, in this case, it went through, and the land trust owns the land in perpetuity, and the homeowner owns the home that's built on that property. And so there's a lottery system that they're still currently developing through the land trust to ensure that you know, a Lahaina family, generational, giving preference to generational families there, are able to stay on this land. They're working on legal ways to define what is a Lahaina resident and using anti-displacement language and policies. And then the structure of the building and the land is tied together through a ground lease, which defines as well, among many other things, that if they decide to sell the house at some point, that it does need to go to another Lahaina resident at an affordable price. So there's agreements there. And, you know, I talked with the Lahaina Community Land Trust folks back in January when they were first forming. They had just, you know, signed paperwork to become a nonprofit. They were figuring out what it all meant and what was going to be possible for them. And so to watch, you know, a grassroots organization like this really making this type of progress is encouraging. You know, it's really amazing to see the work that they've done just in that short amount of time. And when I talked to them more recently, Ness told me about several properties that they were looking at purchasing. Ultimately, those other properties fell through. You know, I'm sure they'll be looking at more here in the near future. But Ness explained what's happening with those Lahaina properties.
The one that went through, we worked directly with the owner and built a relationship and got them what they needed and walked away. With some of the other properties that are listed, they were listed and they're working with a real estate agent and there's commissions and all that stuff, you know, in the middle, first of all. And we got some of the properties appraised independently by multiple appraisers. And we saw what the, you know, quote, market value came back as. And these properties are being listed for nearly $200,000 over market value, which means those are burned lots that are being listed for way over their market value. You can't get a loan on those. So they're marketing them to cash buyers, which means also that those are probably not going to be Lahaina community members that buy those lots. So we're really, really, really at the beginning of charting a course of what's going to happen to Lahaina land. You know, if the real estate industry is marketing burned lots at hundreds of thousand dollars over asking, you can deduct that a lot of those buyers are going to be offshore.
Yeah, it is a real dilemma. I mean, the real estate landscape right now is very interesting. Lots of, I guess, factors beyond people's controls. But, you know, when I heard your story earlier this morning about this, the thing that popped in my mind was, you know, this is leasehold. You know, a lot of the deals that we were seeing with, let's say, Kamehameha Schools with all their leasehold land holdings.
Yeah, it's certainly not, you know, an unusual arrangement for land. A lot of land trusts across the country, whether it be for affordable housing or conservation, are, you know, operate under a similar type of agreement. And, you know, Ness said in this process they don't want to short anybody from Lahaina who's needing that money from the sale of their property just to survive. You know, she totally understands that that's a reality for people, even though they may not want to, that they need that land, you know, that the money from the land. But, you know, she said as far as paying over market value, you know, the organization can't set this pattern and drive up comps in the neighborhood even more. So she's hoping that anybody who finds themselves in that position of really needing to make that difficult decision would contact Land Trust, and they have a lot of, you know, resources that can financially help folks as well.
All right. Well, it'll be interesting to watch their progress. But thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you.
That was Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel with the latest development on the Lahaina Community Land Trust.
Bright skies over Maui. Traffic lines on Front Street. Yellow tailed out in Mala Shores. Land of kings and queens.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember Phil Donahue, the daytime talk show host who pioneered thoughtful discussions of controversial issues and paved the way for others like Oprah. And we remember actress Jenna Rollins, best known for her often improvised independent film collaborations with her husband, John Cassavetes. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following Science Friday.
This Saturday night on The Real Deal, the music of Leonard Bernstein. From Billie Holiday and Tony Bennett, to the Stan Kenton Orchestra featuring Gabe Baltazar. Hope you can join me, Seth Marco, this Saturday night from 8 to 10 on HPR 1.
You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Today's backyard quiz acknowledges the history of Ukrainian immigrants in Hawaii. Over 100 Ukrainians have immigrated to the islands since the Russian invasion in 2022. A federal program called Uniting for Ukraine gives those fleeing the violence a legal way to enter the U.S. and financial support for the duration of their stay. But did you know that at the turn of the 20th century, Ukrainians were brought to work on Hawaii's sugar plantations? According to some historians, about 600 Ukrainian immigrants came to Hawaii beginning in 1897. One couple made such an impact on their local community that a road was named after them. In the town of Mountain View on the Big Island, the husband and wife named Michael and Annie cleared a trail from their 50-acre farm to Volcano Road. Over time, Michael widened the trail and turned it into a proper roadway, which the town's council took over and named in their honor. So, for today's backyard quiz, we want to know what was Michael and Annie's last name, which is also the name of this Big Island road. Call 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right wins a reusable HPR tote bag. Show them.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing access to affordable housing to those with intellectual and developmental disabilities, including ARC of Maui County. NareitHawaii.com.
Duke's Ocean Fest winds up this weekend, and all this week it's featured competitions in paddleboarding, swimming, volleyball, and even dog surfing. And did you know that tomorrow actually marks Duke Kanemoku's birthday? Well, we thought it fitting to share a conversation we had with the author of a new book called The Three Kings, Race, Class, and the Barrier-Breaking Rivals Who Redefined Sports and Launched the Modern Olympic Age. It pays homage to the golden age of swimming and its kings, Duke Kanemoku and two other Olympic champions, California's Johnny Wussmuller and Japan's Katsuo Takaishi. Here's a clip of Duke and Johnny that aired in 1957 from the NBC show This Is Your Life.
Now it's 1924, Duke, Paris, France. At the age of 34, you're again on the Olympic team. I don't. But we'll stick to Hawaii, you know? I mean, you seem to be doing all right in there. The world is watching anxiously to see if Duke Kahanamoku will retain his title.
This was my first Olympic meet, and I was many years younger than Duke.
Yeah, full old.
Yeah, Duke, the only man. Who could, what did that mean? Or maybe you shouldn't tell me.
Cover it up.
Oh, the only man who could have defeated you, your former opponent and now close friend, man who himself broke the established world record, Johnny Weissmuller.
Do
you recognize him now that he's Jungle Jim?
Boy, he is Jungle.
Oh, the kids love this guy. Duke actually helped you to beat him, didn't he, Johnny?
Yes, he did. You know, we trained together in the Olympic Games.
Yes.
And this big lug, he just gave me all the confidence in the world.
Well, this is a thrill to see you two together, the guy who finally broke his record. Even though he had a feeling that you were going to beat him, he helped you?
Well, sure. He used to watch me train and take care of me. He made me made me go back and get in that pool and work up and down. He was just like a big brother to the boys.
He gave him the workout.
Yeah. But you know, funny thing, he never worried much about himself. All he wanted to do was be sure that the United States got that 1-2-3 in the Olympic Games.
We did it.
There was a whole family almost working against you.
Incidentally, The Kanemoku brothers were pretty well represented. You know, beside Duke, there was David and Sam on the team. Boy, I was all over them.
How did the 100-meter event in which you all participated turn out, Duke? In what order?
Johnny came first, and I took second place, and my brother Sam got third place.
Thank you, Johnny Weissmuller. Johnny Weissmuller, your own record stood for 25 years. Thank you, Johnny Weissmuller. What a guy.
And now back to that book. Well, it took a bout with a rare spinal cancer and the loss of the use of his legs that pushed the author of Three Kings, Todd Balfe, into the water. It was there he discovered a love for swimming and its history. Balfe says he came across a story about the opening of the Waikiki Natatorium. The anticipation was high as Hawaii's son, Duke Kahanemoku, was to be there to compete with two of his rivals. Balfe sets the stage.
6,000 people are in the stands and in the trees, and there's a traffic jam all over Honolulu. It was just exciting to read about it. And, you know, the draw was Duke Kanemoku was returning to Hawaii to open up the pool, and he had his rivals were there, two of whom were Johnny Weissmuller and Katsuo Takaishi, and both of whom he swam against in the 1924 Olympics in Paris. And that was the more I read into that race, the more I wanted to know how they got to Paris in 1924. So really, that opened the door to the origins of each swimmer's culture, the background, and the path that they took. Very, very different, but really interesting to contrast those different paths as they got to Paris in 1924.
And you talk about race and class and how they really had to navigate, you know, a different battle outside of the water.
Yeah. I think that recently Charles Barkley, the basketball player, was remarking on Willie Mays and what he had to endure. This was just after Willie Mays had passed away. And Willie Mays, we have no idea what those people like Willie Mays, like all the pioneers of color, had to go through just to play their sports. They're the true heroes. And that really goes for Duke and what he had to endure and his willingness to put it out there, to go to the mainland, to swim against rivals who really were people wanted to see him fail, which he didn't. And I think Duke's personality was such that he minimized some of the trials that he went through to get to the world stage as he did. But you look at the obstacles in front of them, whether it's racism, classism, you know, he overcame so much, you know, and his path was, it was the most dramatic of the three. But even Johnny Weissmuller, who I came into the research of this book thinking, well, here's a very privileged guy. He ends up to be Tarzan. He makes millions, where Duke had to struggle through his life in Hollywood trying to find any type of role that were meaningful. And Weissmuller also, as an immigrant to Chicago in the early 1900s, with a father who walked out the door when he was young, he had a surprising number of obstacles himself. And Takeishi, as the Japanese swimmer, he was, nobody knew anything about Japanese swimming and the heritage of that sport in Japan, which was magnificent. So, you know, and he also was looked upon as other, not belonging, not somebody that belonged at the Olympics in 1924. So I think that all three of them really deserve a really close look.
Share with our listeners what you discovered about swimming in Japan.
Well, I mean, I think that I really no idea when I started to do the research that, you know, it had such heritage. And as I looked into it, it was clear that the samurai history to swimming in Japan, obviously hundreds and hundreds of years of that, had gone into innovation and developing strokes for different bodies of water. So this was mainly for warfare purposes, but there was this incredible school of training and teaching, and it really hadn't been something that the idea of swimming in the Olympics was not really primary to anything that the Japanese were doing before, you know, early 1900s. But when, in the early 1910, 1915, they decided to turn their attention to how do you swim as fast as possible, they quickly turned the page to become rivals in the pool. And, you know, in very short amount of time, they became dominant in the sport. And I think that a lot of people didn't understand how that happened, not really regarding how much glory they had in their past and their culture and how much it was valued. They needed to take a leap from swimming for survival with the natural obstacles in living in an island nation to actually getting in the pool and gaining notoriety and fame for the country.
And what was it about your research with Johnny that maybe surprised you?
Yeah, I think that for Johnny, he was the youngster of them. You know, he was almost half Duke's age, and he was set about really breaking all of Duke's records, which doesn't feel like a great thing to be a part of from Duke's perspective. But what I learned about Johnny, which I thought was really interesting, was like he was deeply envious of Duke and his home. He didn't have really a home in Chicago, and even in L.A., it was sort of transient. But Duke had this culture that was so rich and from a family that was extensive and close-knit. And it became pretty clear that Johnny not only wanted the records, he wanted more. He wanted what Duke had in the way of a life. Sadly, he never got to that place. But I think that, you know, it made Johnny more empathetic to me, I think, than I originally had seen him as.
Any final thoughts that you want to just leave with our listener about this book and this snapshot in time?
Just that reason I spent a lot of time in Hawaii a couple of years ago was I felt that the legacy of Duke was so terrific and it was very much alive. And I felt like hopefully this book brings a little fuller picture of the other swimmers who also made up this glory in this golden era and sends that somewhat because their legacies haven't really endured the way that Duke's has. So hopefully this makes a difference.
Fascinating perspective. You know, and Balfe shared that on a past visit to Honolulu during the Duke's Ocean Fest, he was able to get in the waters off the Waikiki War Memorial Natatorium thanks to the nonprofit Access Surf and a special wheelchair to get him into the ocean. He says it was a thrill. And we can share that the author will return to Honolulu for the Hawaii Book and Music Festival in October, which you're happy to learn will be in person once again, the first time since the pandemic.
Support for HPR comes from the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, committed to supporting Native Hawaiian homeowners and renters impacted by the Maui wildfires. More about its Kanaho grant at oha.org/kanaho grant.
The White House wants high-speed internet for all by 2030. In the meanwhile, you could always stop by the library.
Our public use computers, the usage is going down very quickly. Our Wi-Fi numbers, on the other hand, are through the roof.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, Libraries Footing the Internet Bill. Next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. Learn more about becoming a member and experiencing art in a variety of ways, including exhibition openings and events at honolulumuseum.org.
Well, now it's time to reveal the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we shared with you the history of Ukrainian immigrants in Hawaii. The first hundreds arrived in the 1890s to work on the sugar plantations. And while some moved to the continent or went back to Eastern Europe after their contracts ended, others stayed behind and built lives for themselves and their families. Some, like the Sasko brothers, worked on a plantation on Hawaii Island's Hamakua coast, then moved to Honolulu for better work. Earlier today in the show, we asked about an immigrant couple who lived in Mountain View on the Big Island who had a road named after them. Michael and Annie both died in the first half of the 20th century, but their legacy lives on in the road that shares their last name. The name of that road is North Pisic Road. That's spelled P-S-Z-Y-K. And congrats to Dave Bishop of Mountain View. You got it right. That's our quiz for today. If you have an idea for one to share, write to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. Stand-up comedian Paula Poundstone will be on Oahu tomorrow night. You probably know her best as a panelist on the NPR show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and the host of the podcast Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone. She's also released several comedy specials and played roles in film and television. The Conversations' Russell Subiono recently got the chance to connect with Poundstone ahead of her show at Hawaii Theater.
I recently did an interview with Alonzo Bowden, so I'm like slowly collecting all the panelists from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, just like you guys were action figures.
Like the 70s. The commercials in the 70s, collect them all.
Yeah, exactly.
Sometimes I think I still have that in my head. Like if I'm at a store, like I still have that idea that you somehow have to have all of them because it was that collect them all guy's voice saying it.
One thing I talked to him about was how growing up in New York kind of innately made him funny. I read that you grew up in Massachusetts. Everyone that I know from Massachusetts, which is not that many, have a great sense of humor. Do you think where you grew up had a hand in you being so funny?
Nah, no, I don't. I think that a sense of humor is a coping mechanism that nature has given us. And yeah, I mean, I guess maybe some people wield it better than others. I'm not sure. It also depends sort of where you place your values in terms of that sort of thing. I love making people laugh. The first sentence of the last paragraph of the summary letter written by my kindergarten teacher, Mrs. Bump, in May of, I think it might have been 1964, was, "I have enjoyed many of Paula's humorous comments about our activities." And I think the idea that an adult liked something that I did really impacted me. And maybe she wasn't the only adult who responded that way. I'm not sure. But yeah, I don't think it's regional by any means. People like to say, you know, comics are, let's face it, somewhat self-involved because we're sort of in our heads a lot, you know, thinking about how to do this job. And because we're performers and so we're in front of people. And if you weren't, you know, if you didn't have a somewhat strong ego, you couldn't be a comic because you would have been torn apart by now and that would be the end of it. But I do not believe that ridiculous trope that somehow, you know, early childhood suffering made you a good comic. Because I can think of about, you know, a billion other jobs where one has suffered more than one has as a comic. That's just stupid. We just bought into that a long time ago and said that's what people think, that sort of tears of a clown thing.
You have this clip on YouTube from the Just for Laughs Festival in 2018 where you do this bit on the bright side of a nuclear war.
You know, I went to get a physical and it was a new doctor. So they said, you have to fill out new patient forms. And I go and they give me the clipboard with the things and there was a survey on there. And there was only two questions on the survey. And the first one was, do you feel tired and depressed and hopeless? And I'm looking around the waiting room like, this is gonna be a trick question. I'm like, well, yes. I check, yes, of course. And then the next question was, how often? Like, rarely, sometimes, or every day? And I'm like, well, every day. Has this doctor not seen the news? Every day. I watched the News Hour in the States on PBS, and Judy Woodruff interviewed Joe Biden not too long ago. And she said, do you think we're as close to nuclear war as we've ever been? And he said, yeah. And, you know, I try to look on the bright side, which is I think that nuclear war is going to bring back folk music. I love folk music.
One thing I think comedians do well, and you in particular, is getting laughs by finding the lighter side of serious things, especially when we look at the political landscape. When you look at our current political landscape now with this kind of swing in momentum between our presidential candidates, do you see anything funny in there? Have you worked on any bits or anything?
I'm sure there is. Have I worked on any bits regarding it? Not really. I'll tell you, I'm enjoying the swing. And who knows where we'll land? We don't have the answer yet. But when Kamala Harris and Tim Walz became the, you know, the presumptive nominees, I felt like I hadn't felt joy in so long. I didn't know what to wear. I am enjoying the wave of whatever it is we're on right now as much as the next guy and feeling some hope. I feel like there'll be time for jokes, say they were to be elected. I don't anticipate perfection. I imagine there'll be, you know, room for criticism here and there. But at this point, they may be rescuing us from just a horrible fate of our democracy going down the tubes. I remember when Clinton first got elected, I swear I'm not making this up, a local CBS, the local CBS, asked if they could come to my house and interview me. And I said, yeah. And so they came. And I swear to you, what they wanted to know is, what was funny about Clinton? And I just felt like, could we take a day and just be glad that he's there? And the truth, you know, the truth is, I mean, Trump writes the jokes himself. And I would look forward to a time where politics isn't even that funny. I'll make stuff up. I mean, not about them, but I don't need there to be disaster in order to find comedy in things.
Many of our listeners are familiar with you from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, as well as your podcast, Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone. What does being a panelist on Wait, Wait give you an opportunity to do that you don't get with traditional stand-up setting?
Well, when I first got hired on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, one of the things that strikes me, and it was a long time ago, I think 23 years. So at that time they recorded, we were not in the same room together. We were in studios, but we were not in the same room together. We didn't perform in front of a live audience. And so I get this headset. I had never been on the show before. It's my first time. Put the goofy headset on. I had very little explanation about what it was I was supposed to do. And the show starts up, and I was mostly just sort of listening. And then the director comes out of my headset and he goes, jump in anytime you want, say whatever you want. That is remarkable. That's like, at that point, in any kind of like, you know, television show kind of setting, you know, like show kind of setting I had ever been in, is the polar opposite of what they always said to me. It was always, you know, oh, we're hiring you because we like you, but don't say anything. Don't try not to say anything. So this idea that you were sort of unleashed to say whatever you want. And obviously there's some manners, I guess, of being on stage with other people. And one of the great things about Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is when someone says a joke and then somebody thinks of something else that, you know, to add to it, and then somebody else thinks of something else to add to it, I don't think anybody comes away going, well, there's none of that there. None of it. It's like hanging around at a bar with your friends. Although, having said that, and I'm certainly not there in a roast capacity, but I do just enjoy the heck out of knocking Peter Sagal off his horse every so often. And it doesn't happen often, but, you know, I'm laying in the reeds waiting, just watching.
I think that's a lot of our favorite moments, too, when we're listening, is hearing the comics take a crack at Peter.
There was a show one time, and somebody videoed a moment from this. I forget what it is he had said. He made a mistake about something, and it struck me as funny. Something he said, I don't know, wasn't right or came out wrong, or we had to do a retake, something. And I got laughing so hard that we literally had to, like, stop. And I was trying to, like, get myself together because it was like, okay, it's been a while. It's time to move on. And every time I thought about, or the other thing is, like, I think some of the panelists didn't understand what I was laughing about. And I'm not sure that Peter did. And so every time I tried to explain it, it just made me laugh again. And I howled, honestly, for several minutes. But it was a really, really funny thing. Maybe my peak experience on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And then everything he tried to say afterwards, I think even when he said, this is NPR, I howled. Just the idea that he would maybe not be able to get through something so simple was exciting to me somehow. I don't know how the guy stands me.
The next Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me panelist that I'd like to add to my collection is either Tom Baudet or Mo Rocca. Who do you think I should stock next for an interview?
Boy, that is it. That's a neck and neck. I don't know. I love both those guys. They're both really, really fun and really, really funny. Okay, do you want to hear a Tom Baudet story?
Yes, please.
So Tom now lives in Vermont. And when my son was maybe in high school, maybe junior high, I can't remember anymore, I was working a town either next door or the town that Tom lives in, maybe, in Vermont. And he invited me and my son to stay at his house, you know, while we were in his town. And so we did. And they gave us each rooms, big old house. Tom's a great woodworker and builds a lot. So when we all got back from the show, my son and I were still wide awake because we were on a different time zone. So everybody goes up to bed at some point. And my son comes in my room to watch an I Love Lucy on my mini DVD player. And we're, you know, now it gets like late. And I say, you know, okay, I think we should go to sleep. We got to get up in like an hour. So we go to look for, we're going to turn the lights out, but we can't find the light switch. So we slept with the lights on at Tom Baudette's house. But, you know, he always did those ads for Motel 6 where he says, we'll leave the light on for you.
Oh, shoot. So, yeah. What a great way to wrap up this interview. I don't know if you caught it, but that last question was also my callback.
Oh, no, I didn't.
Paula Poundstone, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me this morning.
Can't wait to be there. Thank you so much.
And that was comedian Paula Poundstone talking with HBR's Russell Subiono. Poundstone will be bringing her act to Oahu's Hawaii Theater tomorrow night at 8 p.m. We'll have a link to more information on the conversation page of our website after the show. Well, that is it for this Aloha Friday. Coming up next week, we'll batten down the hatches, Big Island. You're up first for Tropical Storm Hone. Call our talkback line. Give us some feedback, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find the conversation as a podcast. Look on our website or on Spotify, Apple, or Google. Our program is produced by Russell Subiono, Lillian Song, and Maddie Bender, with help from Savannah Harriman-Pote. And we say mahalo, a big mahalo to our summer intern, Alyssa Salcedo, who heads back to the University of Hawaii. Backyard Queen, a quiz theme written for us by John DeMello. Theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.